Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
A little bit more here on the Tucker Carlson incident. Washington police investigating a protest outside the home of Fox News host Tucker Carlson as a possible hate crime. According to the police report, a group of demonstrators gathered outside of Carlson's Northwest Washington home on Wednesday night. A video posted but later removed showed people standing outside a darkened home chanting, "Tucker Carlson, we will fight. We know where you sleep at night." Officers got there, 20 protesters, and a commonly used anarchy symbol spray painted on the driveway. No arrests, but police confiscated several signs. It lists the incident as a suspected hate crime on the basis of anti-political bias. That's very interesting. And then you have everything going on with Jim Acosta, which is getting a lot more coverage than that. But let me take some phone calls here. On the Acosta situation, I heard Mr. Mayor at the top of the hour in our newscast talking about how this is an affront to journalism and sends a chilling message. I think Jim Acosta acted like an idiot in that room yesterday. So are people concerned? Are you concerned about the message that that revocation of his credential sends to reporters in Washington? Now, I've long defended journalism, and I will continue to do that, but I simply can't defend Acosta's behavior. Now, quite honestly, I can't defend the president's behavior in most instances either, but let's talk about Jim Acosta. 436-7900, 436-7900. 1-800-925-1120 if you want to jump in here. Here's what happened when he showed up last night. The Secret Service asked for his credential.
Why do you mind? I mean, it's...
I was just told to do it.
Okay, well, I have every right to record this. This is Jim Acosta. I am in front of the White House. Secret Service officer is asking for my hard pass. Obviously, no hard feelings to the officer.
Yeah, and then he goes on, and basically they take the credential. He goes on CNN.
You know, I was just trying to ask a question of the president at this press conference, and it was obviously a question they didn't like. It was about his racist ad on the caravan that they were running before the midterms. He and I were going back and forth there, and as you can see in this video, this intern came up to me. They're describing her as an intern. I don't really know who she is.
Now, let me stop him right there, because there's something that should leap out at you there. In that first part of what he said.
You know, I was just trying to ask a question of the president at this press conference, and it was obviously a question they didn't like. It was about his racist ad on the caravan.
All right, so that's definitively Jim Acosta, a journalist, a reporter, a non-biased reporter, calling that ad racist. So I don't know if it's racist or not, but it's not his job to tell us that it's racist. It's not his job to tell the president or anyone else that the caravan isn't an invasion. That's not his role. He can ask questions about whether or not it's an invasion. Mr. President, why do you think that this is an invasion? Can you explain that? But to go up there, pontificate, lecture the president, go back on CNN with all kinds of opinions. Now, if Jim Acosta wants a show, he might even have a show, I don't know. If he wants to be Anderson Cooper, if he wants to be Rachel Maddow, give him a show. But that's not his role. He's a reporter in the White House briefing room. So I don't think that that's journalism. I'm very disappointed in all the journalists out there who are banding together, acting like Jim Acosta did everything right. Let's take some calls. Gene, you're on KMOX. Good afternoon.
Hey, Mark. Part of it's exactly what you just said. He said he couldn't ask a question. That was the first thing I heard. He did ask a question, and he got an answer from the president.
And he didn't like it, right? He didn't like the answer.
Yeah. The president feels it's an invasion, as a lot of people do. Jim doesn't feel that way. Okay, that's fine. Doesn't mean Jim's right. Doesn't mean the president's right. They have a difference of opinion. Then he wanted to ask another question. Well, I don't know that I've ever watched one of those press briefings where they let one reporter ask multiple questions. It's usually one and maybe a follow-up to that exact question.
Yeah, there might be one or two or maybe three altogether, but they usually ask for permission. Can I have a follow-up? And usually that's granted.
Right.
Right.
The other thing is, these press people, it amazes me. It is not a right to be a press person to be in the White House, that is a privilege. It's not a right.
Oh, I completely agree with you. That's right.
So, you know, I CNN, okay, well, Jim got ousted by the White House. They didn't oust CNN. So CNN puts a different reporter in there, takes care of that problem.
Do you think, though, you know, one of the criticisms that Howie Kurtz said on Fox earlier today, and I played this cut, is that it might make him, well, here, let me see here if this is what he says. It might make him into a bit of a martyr. Let's see if I jump ahead to this here.
And by taking the exceedingly rare step, Harris, of yanking Acosta's credentials, may have taken a step toward turning him into a bit of a martyr because others in the news business are now standing behind him. What's gotten lost is what he did.
All right, any truth to that, you think?
You know, he is going to be a martyr to the liberals, to the majority of the country. He's not. He is rude to almost everyone. He's rude when he is at the Trump rallies. You know, he complained that it was too loud and he couldn't do his whatever they call that talk, you know, when he was reporting on the Trump rally that one time. He's at a Trump rally. What do you think?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I just don't get it. You know, and it's...
Well, look, he's trying to gin this up. He knows exactly what he's doing when he's holding the microphone and shouting the president down. He wants the attention. He knows he's going to be featured. He makes the story about himself. And,
right.
And that's fine, but at least be honest about it and don't act like you're a purist journalist, you know, journalist that's just trying to get answers to questions. That's not the case. Richard, you're on KMOX.
Yeah,
turn the radio down if you would for me.
I will.
There you go.
Okay. I found his actions rude, which is not unusual for him. But when the intern came over to take the microphone, I've never seen in all the years, and I used to work in Washington, that a reporter refused to give it up.
Never seen that. I haven't either.
So I have no problem.
Not only refused to give it up, but for quite some time. I mean, this is all very condensed. It wasn't like it went on for minutes, but he had ample opportunity to hand the microphone over when the president decided he was moving on, and he wouldn't do it.
No, it's he was a grandstander. I think it would help if he read an Emily Post book on etiquette. But the fact that they pulled him.
See, they don't care. This is the thing, Richard. They're emboldened by this. They love this. And with everyone else that's, you know, getting behind them, all the rest of the media is solidarity. I'm all for the media standing behind fellow journalists who are treated unfairly. And I do have a problem with the president calling the media the enemy of the people. But I also have a problem with biased journalism. And Jim Acosta is probably exhibit A when it comes to that. John, you're on KMOX.
Yeah. I'm not going to get into which side of the political fence I'm on. But as far as I'm concerned, Acosta deserved to be bounced. What he was attempting to do was get under President Trump's skin. But what he actually did was he disrespected the office of the president. And I don't care what news agency you're from or what your political persuasion is, you don't disrespect the office of the president of the United States, period, end of sentence.
And let me challenge you on that just a minute, because I know what people who don't like the president are going to say, and there may be a little bit to this, is the president has sort of disrespected the office with his tone, his rhetoric, and the way that he behaves as well.
Yeah, you can say that. President Trump can be abrasive at times. I will give you that. And I'm, to some extent,
Look, I don't disagree with you. I think it was disrespectful, and it's not the way that, no matter what kind of questions you're asking or you're trying to get answered, is a way to behave in the White House briefing room or anywhere else.
No, there is a certain way. You go back and look at press conferences from the, and I'm going to skip the Obama administration, but you go back and look at the press conferences in both Bush administrations and the Clinton administration, Reagan, Carter, LBJ, all the way back to John F. Kennedy. The press never acted like that.
Let's talk about Ronald Reagan and even George Bush and probably into Bill Clinton. I can't remember if it was George W. Bush. You remember who used to get the first question traditionally in the room? Helen Thomas. Remember Helen Thomas?
Yeah.
UPI reporter. I think she was UPI, which, hard to believe, she was UPI for all those years when UPI wasn't really doing much. And Helen Thomas was no conservative. In fact, after she stopped reporting, she was exposed, not shockingly, as quite the liberal, like Dan Rather. But she asked tough questions and was respectful.
You're absolutely right. You are 100% right. Helen Thomas did ask tough questions. Helen Thomas expected an answer to her question. But Helen Thomas never did anything close to what Acosta pulled. And Helen Thomas was always the commensurate pro in the room.
Well, that's right. And there's a big difference. Now, I guess, again, you can go back and say, well, Ronald Reagan didn't behave like Donald Trump. I don't know if that's an excuse or not. Chuck, you get the final word on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've heard all this and listened to it. But the thing you have to remember is, I'm sure you've read it, and there's other people who have, and I know Acosta's read it, the book Rules for Radicals. It's right out of the book. You push and push until you get a negative reaction, and then you build on that negative reaction to push some more. And that's the way they operate.
Hey, Chuck, did you actually see this, or were you just hearing the audio?
Yes, I saw.
And the reason I bring it up is because there was a moment that I thought, well, first of all, I thought the president was just going to turn away. But, man, there was a moment for about 3 or 4, 5 seconds where it looked like something even more dramatic was going to happen.
Yep, and the president controlled himself.
I'm surprised that he did. I don't know that I could have done the same thing if Jim Acosta was doing that to me. We'll take a break. We're going to talk about what's next. Thanks for the call, Chuck. I appreciate it. And everyone that chimed in here this afternoon. Take a break here. We'll talk with our buddy Jack Cardetti, who was involved with New Approach Missouri Amendment 2. That's one of the weed initiatives, the one that passed overwhelmingly. So now the question is, what happens in Missouri? Also, director Jason Reitman, his brand new movie is outstanding. It's called The Front Runner. It's about Gary Hart's failed presidential race in 1988. Jason's in town, was at the St. Louis International Film Festival last night, where he did a little Q&A after the screening. We have him in studio in about 15 minutes on KMOX.
Local reporters to cover local news. St. Louis's news, traffic, and weather.
Reardon Roundtable tomorrow, post-election edition. John Lamping, former state senator. Jack Cardetti will be on that panel. He's the only one I'm disappointed that we booked for tomorrow. Oh, wait a second. He's on the line right now, isn't he? How are you, Cardetti?
Yeah, I really appreciate that intro, Mark.
No, I'm looking forward to it. We should have a good one tomorrow. Jane will be here. You will be here. And Senator Lamping, let's talk about weed, though. That'll be an issue that comes up tomorrow, but you were involved with New Approach Missouri as a spokesperson, Medicinal Marijuana Amendment 2. Were you surprised that, and I gave credit to the electorate on, I guess it was just yesterday, because I'm losing track of days, that they paid attention to the differences between these proposals, Jack?
Yeah, that really was one of the real great things from the election, is that voters really went in. They had three choices on medical marijuana, and not, you know, conventional wisdom was that they would just vote yes on all three or no on all three. But voters actually sought out information, came to the polls prepared, and the results show that. I mean, Amendment 2 got 66% of the vote, whereas Amendment 3 got 31% of the vote.
I was so really, were you surprised by that? Because I certainly was. Because I think a lot of people thought, well, you know, folks who support this, and maybe people did this, you're just going to say yes on all of them, not really knowing the intricacies and the nuances and stuff. But obviously, whatever you guys did with your campaign and just the interviews that were done, people knew the differences.
Yeah, people really sought out information about it. And the credit goes to the campaign. I mean, we were a campaign, a coalition of veterans and patients and healthcare providers that really ran an aggressive grassroots campaign and digital campaign, got a lot of information out to voters, and they responded. I mean, Mark, one of the things I'm proud of, not only was it a historic night for patients and veterans with the passage of Amendment 2, us becoming the 31st state to allow for medical marijuana, but Amendment 2 actually was the largest vote getter on the entire Missouri ballot on Tuesday.
Was it really?
It got more votes than any other candidate or issue. I mean, to put it into perspective, we got more than 1.5 million yes votes on Tuesday. I mean, we have 322,000 more votes than Josh Hawley got to get elected U.S. Senate, and 84,000 more than the minimum wage increase got, the second most popular issue.
That is very interesting. Too bad you couldn't have donated some of those votes to Senator McCaskill, Jack.
I appreciate that, Mark. I'll get to explain more of that
tomorrow. Yeah, we'll do more of that tomorrow. But here's my question, though, is so what happens now? I have, I don't know, 5 or 6 plants have been growing for months in my basement. Can I do that? Oh, wait, I'm just kidding, by the way. Can I do that legally now? And I'm in all seriousness, though, because I think people want to know the answers. What's next? What happens?
Yeah, it's a great question. So under Missouri law, constitutional amendments that are passed by the voters go into effect 30 days later. So come December 6th, this will officially be in law. But then the Missouri Department of Health, which will regulate, implement, and oversee this entire program, has several months that they'll put in rules. And then there, we set in the amendment several strict deadlines that they have to meet so that patients can quickly start getting relief and access to this. So the first thing really is the first week of June next year. Before then, they have to put out an application to patients, and patients can start going to see their doctor and get a recommendation for medical marijuana and turn that back into the Missouri Department of Health. So a lot of this will happen late next spring, early next summer. And then we expect the full dispensaries to be open, all of that, late next year, if not January of 2020.
All right. So who are the people involved in the dispensaries, and how does that work exactly? I mean, obviously you have states out there that are very functional when it comes to not only medicinal marijuana, but recreation use and recreational use of marijuana. So the dispensaries, how many are they going to be? Who's deciding all that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So under Amendment 2, the Missouri Department of Health will make all of those decisions. They have the expertise in these matters. They're accountable to the executive and legislative branch. It's a transparent process. So people will make applications next summer to the Missouri Department of Health to be a licensed dispensary or a licensed cultivation. As far as dispensaries, there will be at least 24 dispensaries in all 8 of Missouri's congressional districts. So those will be dispersed geographically, at least 24 dispensaries in every one of Missouri's 8 congressional districts. We thought that was important because we don't think if you and your doctor agree that you have cancer, epilepsy, PTSD, and you need medical marijuana as a treatment option, you shouldn't have to drive halfway.
Okay, wait. Just to clarify here, you're saying 24 in each district or 24 total?
No, 24 in each district.
Okay, now that seems like a lot to me, especially if we're only talking, I could see a number like that if we're talking recreational, but for medicinal marijuana use, that seems excessive, maybe.
No, in fact, in the state of Oklahoma that just passed last summer, our medical marijuana program, they've already handed out thousands of licenses. So we really, and then the extreme of that is the state of Arkansas, which only handed out a few. So we have really hit sort of a middle ground here. We want patients to have affordable access to this, but we don't want to see it on every single street corner.
All right, so let's say that there's a dispensary out where I live in that area, but I don't have any ability to be prescribed medicinal marijuana. So does that mean I can't go into that dispensary? And certainly I can't buy marijuana. Can I go into the dispensary and retail shop or, you know, kind of look?
So those rules will be written by the Missouri Department of Health. But for the most part, Mark, unless you have unless you're a qualified patient with a patient card from the Missouri Department of Health, you will not even be able to step foot in.
Right, which makes sense. But that's why I was asking.
We anticipate, Mark, that about, based on our qualifying conditions, based on other states that have similar programs, they have about 2% of their population that has a patient card. And we think it'll be somewhere similar to Missouri. So this is going to provide real relief to some people, but you're not going to see everyone walking around with it.
So you got a 4% tax on the retail sales. That's going to go toward veterans' health care. How do you come up with the estimate that it would generate about $18 million a year?
Yeah, so that's from the Missouri Auditor's Office. She looked at other states, as we did, that have similar laws, and based on their amount of population, their amount of sales, we think that's about what it'll generate.
How does the home grow portion of this work, and how will that be implemented, and what protections are there to, you know, I was obviously joking about the 6 plants in my basement, or was I? But, you know, there are people that might take it upon themselves, and there are people out there that are probably growing right now to say, hey, look, now I have a legitimate use to do this.
So most Missourians will access this once they get their patient card from dispensaries, by and large. But there is a provision in here that allows next summer for a patient that already has a patient card, already has been recommended by their doctor, to also apply to the Missouri Department of Health to have patient cultivation, which means that in their indoor facility, in a separate room under lock and key, available for inspection to the Missouri Department of Health, they could grow up to 6 plants.
Will any of this prevent the Reardon Roundtable panel from, I don't know, next July or August, taking a bunch of edibles before the show?
that is up
Which
to
could you. Be pretty entertaining if you think about it.
That's up to your producer, I think.
So. Dave Klein, that's you. You get to decide that. Well, it's interesting, and I know you worked hard on this campaign. My deal is, and I know you're going to push back on this, but Michigan just approved recreational marijuana, and I've always thought that these things are certainly a step in that direction, which, by the way, I would support, but you're saying we're stopping here? What do we go from here on that?
Yeah, Missouri is going to be a medical marijuana state. We're the 31st state in the country. If you look at the different states that have adult use, right, Michigan obviously joined them, but by and large, they're on the East Coast or the West Coast. It'll stay that way for a while. I mean, the real goal here is to get a really good medical marijuana program up and running in Missouri that really helps patients, that helps veterans, and we think that that's entirely possible. We are really thrilled with the vote. Like I said, 66% of Missouri voted in favor of this. I mean, we're more popular than Donald Trump. We're more popular than any politician in the state, but it's good to see Missourians coalesce around a really good idea. And like you said, make an informed choice at the ballot.
Yeah, I was impressed. I was impressed by that. Jack Hardetti, New Approach Missouri. We'll see you tomorrow on the Reardon Roundtable. Should be a good one. Thanks, Jack. And by the way, for the record, in case people are listening, law enforcement, I really don't have six plants in my basement. That was a joke. I don't need black helicopters or anything, you know, tracking me down, right?
I thought you ran with the black helicopter crowd.
Yeah, I guess I do. All right, Cardetti, see you tomorrow. It is 3:30 at the Voice of St. Louis. Yeah, he's going to be on the Roundtable panel tomorrow. Let's go right to the news. Dave, are we going right to the news? Yeah, you know, I guess we can. Jason Reitman on the other side of that. He has directed a really good new movie called The Front Runner. It's about 1988's failed presidential campaign for Colorado Senator Gary Hart. Really interesting. Hugh Jackman, Vera Farmiga, J.K. Simmons, great cast. Jason Reitman, who was here in St. Louis, of course, to make and film Up in the Air many years ago. I can't even remember how many years. We'll ask him. He's coming up next on KMOX.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey folks, Chris Kerber with you here, and it's Eric Carlson, Brent Burns, Joe Thornton, and the San Jose Sharks skating into town on Friday night. It's the Blues hosting the San Jose Sharks, 6:30 pregame, 7 o'clock faceoff, this Friday night on the home of your St. Louis Blues, KMOX. Let's go!
Brand new movie from director Jason Reitman about Gary Hart's presidential campaign in 1988. It's called The Front Runner.
I've never known a guy more talented at untangling politics so that anyone can understand.
Gary Hart
is bringing bold and inventive ideas into American politics.
It is a gift, and he wants to share that with people.
Hart is pushing groundbreaking reforms
on education and foreign policy.
I want you to think about the opportunity that we have right now and the cost to this great country if we squander it.
What a great cast with Hugh Jackman, and you heard J.K. Simmons there, director Jason Reitman in town for a screening of this at the St. Louis International Film Festival last night. He's been here before because he filmed Up in the Air. He joins me this afternoon. Jason Reitman, great to have you. How are you?
I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, welcome back to St. Louis.
Thank you very much. You know, it's a kind of flood of memories as I arrive here, you know, because I land at Lambert and as I walk off the jet bridge, I'm basically back on the set of Up in the Air. The moment I step into the airport, I'm seeing, you know, gates that Clooney walked by. I see the security area where Clooney taught how to go through security to Anna Kendrick. I get in the car. The moment I leave, I'm seeing, you know, the Airport Hilton where Clooney gave his We Are Not Swans, We Are Sharks speech. So as I drive through St. Louis, I am kind of driving down memory lane of making Up in the Air.
How many years ago was that? I don't even want to hear that because...
Oh, man, it's almost 10 years.
Is it? No way.
Yeah.
Has it really been that long?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, what a great movie, though.
Yeah, just think of the St. Louis Blues and how they've ebbed and flowed since that movie. Because I remember they went to the playoffs while we were shooting there, and then they,
they got good again.
Yeah,
they did get good again. Was this year? Are you a hockey guy?
I do like hockey.
Yeah, we're kind of in that high expectations for the Blues this year, really high. And Has not been there yet, but it's early in the season.
I remember finding it fascinating that the team, a lot of the team had to play with the breathe right strips because of the pollen in the air affected them so much playing here in St. Louis.
And I did not know that.
I thought that was fascinating.
That is fascinating. Yeah. That is fascinating. Oh, well, tell me about this movie. I had a chance to see it a couple of weeks ago. I'm a big political guy. That's what I mostly do on my show. So I'm fascinated by this story, first and foremost, because I remember that campaign. It was in my first years as a budding young journalist, as I graduated from Mizzou in 1986. So I was doing some news back then. And it was a pretty big story with Gary Hart, right?
Yeah. And it's an interesting story that kind of plays with our memory, because people have very specific memories of what happened, and they kind of remember it as a joke, you know, the name of a boat. And this came into my life 3 years ago as a Radiolab story, actually. And
meaning what?
Radiolab did a piece on Gary Hart, specifically on Matt Bai's book on the Gary Hart scandal. And I was 10 years old when this happened. When this first happened, you know, I was much more interested in the trajectory of the Back to the Future trilogy.
Right, right.
Yeah,
right.
I only brought this up to kind of throw my age out on the table.
And
but,
to make me feel older.
Anything I can do to antagonize the interviewer. But honestly, in hearing the story a few years ago, as told by Matt Bai, it really kind of revealed how much connective tissue the story had with where we are today.
All the questions
we're asking today about gender politics, about the relationship between politicians and journalists, and, you know, what is a private life? What is a public life? What kind of flaws are we willing to put up with in our leaders? I mean, these are all central to the Gary Hart scandal.
You know, the one thing I think I read in some of the notes is there are reporters that are featured, obviously, from mainstream media news outlets, but it was the first year that A Current Affair came about, right?
It's exactly right. You know, this is the year that tabloid journalism made that jump from print to television and drove into the lane of political journalism, never really to leave it again.
No.
And also, you know, kind of represents the beginning of the celebrification of being a politician, as we are now treating politicians the way we treat actors. You know, we treat and there's a kind of a paparazzi element of trying to understand more about the private lives of these people, which I think stems from the birth of the primary system in the mid-70s, and, you know, suddenly constituents picking who the candidates were instead of, you know, party bosses and back rooms, and all of a sudden having to kind of figure out who these mayors and congressmen and governors from other states were, when the responsibility fell on the shoulders of journalists to be like, hey, this is who
are. That's right. Director Jason Reitman is with me in the studio. He's here in St. Louis, was here last night for the St. Louis International Film Festival. The movie The Front Runner opens on the 21st.
Yeah.
So Hugh Jackman plays Gary Hart. Nails it here. Did you always want Hugh for the role, and why?
I mean, I did. You know, obviously there's these kind of cosmetic similarities between the two guys. But Hugh Jackman is also one of the great movie stars of our time. You know, whether he is being Logan, Wolverine, P.T. Barnum, Les Mis, he's the kind of actor who just kind of reaches out from the screen and grabs the audience by the ribs and yanks them into the movie. And in this movie, he does something he's never done before. You know, he plays an enigma. He plays someone we're desperately trying to understand who won't let us completely in.
Did you work or meet, or did he meet with Gary Hart at all? Gary Hart's still alive, right?
He's still alive. With his wife. He and his wife have been married. They actually just celebrated their 60th wedding
anniversary.
That's kind of amazing. Yeah, it is amazing. And as anyone who's ever been married will tell you. And I met Gary and Lee. So did Hugh. Hugh actually spent the weekend at their house and got to know him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Look, I mean, it was the first time I made a movie about real life events where the participants would one day see the film. And it was the first time that Hugh made a movie about people who are still alive.
That's
and would one day see the film. And there's an interesting burden that comes with that, you know, because you want to tell. I mean, I would imagine it's similar to the burden that falls on your shoulders, you know, when you're interviewing people. There is probably a combination of a desire to get to the truth and ask the tough questions, but also look across the way at a person who is a human being that you must have some sort of empathy for. So
you don't know me very well, Jason. I don't have empathy for people. That's not me. No, you must be confusing me with somebody else.
There would be journalists that might have
like
empathy.
That, yes. I've heard of that before. Yes.
So look. We knew that at one point Gary would see the film, and he has seen the film. You know, I flew to Denver and showed Gary and Lee and their kids the film. I showed the film to Donna Rice, showed the film to Tom Fiedler from the Miami Herald. And with each screening, it carries in a tremendous amount of anxiety.
So one question I had is that, you know, I think back to 1988, I guess it was 23 at the time. And if you were alive, if you remember these events, you remember that photo of Donna Rice on Gary Hart's lap on Monkey Business. And you didn't use that picture or a recreation of that photo in the film. Why not? I was just curious about that.
No, there is. And this is a really interesting thing. And this is one of the ways that this movie plays with your memory. That photo came out after the fact. Everyone remembers that photo taking down his presidency. And in actuality, he had left politics already. And the National Enquirer bought that photo and published it. But he was already off the scene.
See, there you go.
But I think that's honestly right at the core of why I wanted to make this movie. Because this is a movie about what is relevant, what is important versus what is entertaining. And it is in this moment that this merge happens, where the relevant politics merges with the kind of the entertaining kind of celebrity style details of a story, and they start to become inseparable, leading to a moment like today when, you know, I wake up the same way you do. You open up your news app, and on one side is a story about the midterms, and literally right next to it, from the same source, given equal weight, is a story about Pete Davidson and Ariana Grande breaking up. And they were both labeled, you know, analysis. And, you know, they're given the same exact weight. So there's a kind of confusion about, wait, what is the entertainment story and what is the actual relevant political story?
You know, one of the things, when I think you do this with all your films, and I'm a big fan, I don't want to suck up to you too much here.
Please.
But I like all the movies. But, you know, if I was a doctor, I probably would pick around ER and movies about physicians. But I feel, as a media guy, that most movies don't get the media right. And
right. And
they probably don't get politics right. But you get both right, I think, in this movie, for
That's
sure.
That's very kind of you. Well, look, I'm gonna give credit where credit's due. This is a movie that was co-written by Matt Bai. You know, New York Times Magazine journalist, covered 5 different presidential
elections.
Guy
who wrote
elections.
The book that it's based
on,
right?
Wrote the book
right?
on Hart. And Jay Carson. Jay Carson, who's a political operative, was the press secretary for Hillary Clinton in 08, for Howard Dean, for Tom Daschle. He's a guy. So you're talking about a couple decades worth of political experience, journalism experience, co-writing the movie with me. And, you know, the movie is built on the shoulders of their experience. And this is a movie from the perspective of the journalists. It's from the perspective of the campaign people, almost surrounding Hart. And offers 20 different points of view in.
Oh, yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I love it. And by the way, I want to mention, we can't mention everyone in the cast, but is this one of those films where people don't take the regular scale because there's so many big names in this movie?
Well, I brought a list of all their salaries so we could go through them one by one.
Can we
one.
Do that right now?
Yeah.
How much did Vera Farmiga make? And by the way, she's great. She plays Gary's wife, and you worked with her in Up in the Air. She
yeah,
was here
exactly.
in St. Louis.
Well, it's interesting. You know, between Up in the Air and this movie, she plays two sides of an affair. And I think there's a reason why she's so good for that. I mean, she's someone who doesn't judge her characters, who comes to, you know, material with the kind of nuance that she does, and is kind of able to give either woman a real humanity.
But J.K. Simmons, other people that folks would recognize, going back to my question, is it, I mean, I don't know if this is accurate or not. I don't know if this is considered a mainstream movie or an art film, but typically the big names, they want to be attached to a project like this because of the quality of work and because working with a guy like you. Does that make any sense? In other words, I don't think I'm asking my question
right.
No,
you're right,
you know,
in that
I mean.
We did not have the budget of an Iron Man movie. I mean, this was done for a smaller
right.
budget. It has to be done reasonably, and it has to be done because actors want to make it. And particularly this film, and I'll tell you why. This is a movie where we told the cast, we want you on set every day. Normally, you do a smaller film like this, and an actor kind of gives you a week.
Right.
You shoot out their role, you get on to the next thing. But we wanted to make a movie where everyone was on set every single day. It's a campaign movie. You're on the plane, you're on the bus, you're on the campaign floor, you're on the newspaper floor. Everybody's there. It's commotion, it's noisy.
So you wanted
it's messy.
That energy.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
And not only that, we gave everyone dialogue, but we then, if you didn't have scripted dialogue, we'd give you a magazine from 87 and say, here, read this article and explain it to the person sitting next to you. Everyone was mic'd. Everyone was mic'd on every take.
Wow.
So imagine our mixer in real time mixing 10, 12, 15 mics sometimes.
How did you mic them without us seeing that?
They're all lavved. We also have booms. But you have to imagine our production mixer mixing, playing his mixer like a piano in real time, knowing half the dialogue is scripted, but half of them are improvising, and creating a balance that is usually done in post and doing it in real time on set.
Well, it worked. It worked really well. Again, that adds to the reality of the movie and the legitimacy and the authenticity. So congratulations and welcome back to St. Louis. Come see us anytime. The Front Runner opens on the 21st, so go see it. It's a fascinating look at politics, and it does relate to today, I think. In very interesting ways.
A kind of a thriller. I mean, that's the thing that's kind of wild to remember is this happened in less than a week. A guy went from being the next president of the United States to leaving politics forever in less than a week. And it's just kind of, there's an electricity to watching it happen.
Great job. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
And it's sponsored by the Good Feet Store, pain relief to fit any budget. This is a tough one, but you have the shooting from Thousand Oaks, California. Cody Kaufman, 22 years old, lost his life. His father, Jason, earlier today.
I just want to pray for everybody else that is going to be going through the same situation. There's many more to come. But for me, this is a heart that I'll never get back. I'll never get back.
Your son wanted to serve his country.
My son was on his, he was on his way to fulfilling his dream of serving the country. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the irony here is that the killer identified as a former machine gunner and decorated veteran of the war in Afghanistan, who was interviewed at his home by police last year when there were reports of agitated behavior. It's just, it's gut-wrenching, and it's really hard to go through. That's your cut of the day, unfortunately.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.